Okay, well, I guess I should call things to order here. Welcome to day two of Longwall USA. This is the third session. It's Longwall Operations, Design, and Management. My name is Steve Fiskor. I'm the editor with Coal Age. And I've been asked to remind you that we have an awards luncheon today. Hal Quinn is from the National Mining Association is going to deliver the keynote speech, and we're also going to give out awards to the top three longwall mining operations. There's still some tickets available, so check in at registration if you'd like to attend. That being said, I'd like to introduce our first speakers here. We have co-presenters. We have Brad Hansen, who is the president, CEO of Signal Peak Energy. He's an experienced coal mine executive who's managed longwall operations throughout the western U.S. His 30-year-plus career includes over 15 years of executive management. He started work as a miner and wrestled through the ranks as foreman, mine manager, VP operations, chief operating officer, and president and CEO. He's been working at Signal Peak Energy since August 2010. Presenting with Brad is Bob Oxner, and Bob's the chief engineer at Signal Peak. Chief engineer for Signal Peak Energy at Bull Mountains Mine Number 1, Roundup, Montana. Mr. Oxner received his BS degree in mining engineering from the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. He has more than 30 years experience, and he has extensive experience in the western U.S. coal fields, especially with Signal Peak and Bull Mountain. How about a warm welcome for these two gentlemen?
All right. Can everybody hear me all right? We'll get started. That's a little loud, isn't it? We'll get started. Our paper's on the pre-developed longwall recovery entries, and it's especially critical because we're in low cover. So I'm going to walk you through four different longwall moves that we experienced at the Signal Peak mine. And each one, we made changes and finally come up with a success that works in our particular area. Hopefully we can help others throughout the United States and around the world with the same kind of conditions. We did this with the Signal Peak staff, and I want to say that Keystone Mining's been a big part of this. John Stankus and his team, and then myself and Bob put a lot of work into it. Started off with the failure and ended up with a success story. So we had to come up with something that we could race into an entry and get the longwall out very quickly with the shallow cover. So we had to design something that helped us battle our way through tough mining conditions, which included the low overburden and a very weak sandstone roof and heavily fractured. So this story comes from the guys at work that worked their way through it and battled their way through it. Anyway, in January of 2014, we had our first longwall move with the new recovery system, very successful. We made a few minor tweaks, and we moved again in March of this year with the same kind of success. They've already given a little introduction on Bob and myself. I'm on my 38th year in the coal business, all but a short stint in Australia. I've been in the western United States. I've got 23 years of moving the longwall, experience moving the longwalls. And Bob's got over 30 years experience also in exploration, mine design, permitting, and operations. Gives you an idea where the mine is. We sit directly north of the city of Billings in Montana, up in this area. That's our layout of our southern district and our northern district. They claim, and I'm not sure, but we're supposed to be in the Fort Union coal formation. It's a nice seam. And then on the lithology, this is the Mammoth seam right here. This is what the majority of the mine was built to mine. It's showing 10 feet on this chart, but it gets in the upwards of 17 feet. And as I'm talking through this presentation, you got to pay attention. I'm going to mention the radar seam quite a bit. It runs 2.5 to 3 feet. In between the two, we've got a pretty competent sandstone. It's a weak PSI, very weak. It's a 6,000 PSI. It's heavily jointed. And then the immediate roof on the Mammoth is about 2.5 foot to 3 foot of a mudstone, siltstone. So it gives you an idea. We got a pretty good beam above us. And there's parts of the mine where these two seams come together and we get into upwards of 17 feet of coal. So that'll be later on. But right now we're concentrating on the Mammoth. But it is key in supporting the roof. You got to know where that radar seam is. It's a rider seam named Raider. You got to know where that seam is when you're supporting roof. That's what it looked like when I showed up in August. They were a little past a third of the way in the first longwall panel in the black. And this is an important map to me. All of us use it daily. It's a stability map. Gives you an idea. The blues are our high cover areas. That's called Dunn Mountain. Your 800 foot of cover, the lighter blue 600 foot, and then out in here, the average is 400 foot of cover, but out here where we pull the long wall where you can see the recovery entries, that's around 200 feet, 220 feet max. So we're pulling in a very shallow area. Mine conditions again, low cover, 200 to 800 feet, no methane, competent roof. Unless you're dealing with, I'm going to back up a page, unless you're dealing with where the two seams merge, I skipped that. These lines right here are the inner burden lines between the two seams, and they merge. Everything to the left side of these lines is 17 foot of coal. The Raider and the Mammoth merge. This area is where they merge, and then we come out of it, and we're strictly mining the Mammoth. So when you're pulling the long wall out on the recovery entries, it's strictly Mammoth. It's a very flat seam, about 1%. That's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing. We generate quite a bit of water, and because we're so flat, that water is smeared around everywhere. We've got a fire clay bottom, which makes it tough at times. In the Mammoth seam right now, proven, we've got 278 million tons of coal. There's two other seams below us, and then there's some outcrop coal that someday we might surface mine. Again, no methane, and it's a pretty nice seam all around. Longwall equipment, state of the art. We run a 1,250 foot face, 189 2 meter shields basically, and we run a 7 LS shear, the Joy shields, and then currently we're running a Caterpillar AFC drives, crusher, stage loader, and tailpiece. This is a 5,000 ton per hour system. We switched from exhausting ventilation to blowing in May of 2013. Those of you who know me, that's kind of my style of ventilation in the West. It works well, especially with the spawn comm. Production at our mine runs between 10 and 12 million tons raw per year, 7 to 8.5 clean. First move, we're ready to go conventional, thinking it's going to work just like the rest of the West, right? Conditions for conventional longwall move, we had the shallow cover, 200 feet, normal lithology, normal mining height of 10 feet, and that inner burden between the Raider and the Mammoth is greater than 20 feet. That's a good thing. We got going with the mesh. We had it planned out for 10 passes, started the meshing process, started a loose cap rock, uneven roof, very slow drilling and bowling, fighting the cap rock. Things kind of got ugly, moving very slowly. We had an event where it set down on us, and our yield valves did not reset on our shields, so we had to change them out and go to new. At that time, we lost a lot of leg. We were shooting underneath the pontoons, advancing, and even got to where we needed to be. During the extraction of the AFC headgate tailgate, we started to develop a cutter on the solid rib in this area right here. And you can see the shear line to the surface. That gives us the concern that maybe once the AFC was removed, we'll bring in the Fletcher roof boulder and put some additional roof support in. The The next thing we did is we brought a continuous miner in. We'd lost so much height in this entry that we graded from head gate to tailgate to get our height back. We built 2x4 cribs along the solid rib, showing a crib there. We utilized the Heinzman beam from the crib to the shield tips, and we were able to start extracting shields. At that time, we had the original support installed, and then what we used with the Fletcher roof boulder, a 12-foot and 16-foot cable bolts for a little more insurance. The first 40 shields went very well. We got to shield 41. We had another event where it set down on us, and I'll show you a picture of that. That top picture showing shield 41. That is a Walker shield in the background. It doesn't come out very good, but it's buried. You can see the tips are down on the line shields. That was shield 41. So it was a battle every inch on this conventional style roof move in panel number one. Down below, you're looking up into the cutter on the solid rib. And you can see it's pretty significant. So post one right evaluation, we knew we had significant angle shear subsidence expressions all the way to the surface. It was determined that both the immediate roof and above strata was damaged. So the managers all grouped up and we focused on longwall move number two. We needed to get in and mesh quicker. We needed a system that would hold a dead load with this shallow cover, and we needed a system that would prevent that cutter from happening in the future. So on the drawing board, we brought in Keystone, and we had presented what we put together. They put their engineering and doctors on it and come up with a final plan. We submitted that to AMSHA for approval and moved on. That bottom diagram shows you the angle of that shear. It's angling back over the shield tips, and up on the surface, we were able to survey in. We had 5 foot of subsidence. We also drilled a hole from the surface to see what we had for the strata, and it was all broken up from the coal seam on up. And then there's one more nice picture of what the Walker looked like buried in the background. This is what it looked like after we graded it and built the 2x4 cribs with the Heinzman. Looks pretty good in there. Got good height again. You can see the Heinzman's in the background. Heinzman's there. And we were able to get the rest of the shields out. When we had that second event after pulling shield 40, shield 40 to shield 130 were ironbound completely. So we had the roof, the cutter taken care of, but it was slow going because everything was ironbound and we had to drill underneath each shield to extract it. With all that work in place for the second recovery plan, this is what it was going to look like. You can see where the shields in the final position with the Hoosker laying down. We used the 16-foot fully grouted cable bolts. Those were 12-footers. Over on this end, those were 5-foot headed rebar because we wanted that mesh to lay down behind the canopies when we parked them in final position. And then as far as standing support, we had three rows of 36-inch cuttable cribs on 4-foot centers, 4 by 9. And then this row of 30-inch non-cuttables would be against the solid. We also used a channel across there, and we made sure that the cribs were underneath the T3 channel. And then pay attention down here, the CMRR was 59. The RDI was a 0.99, and then our standing support density was 0.34. At that time, this was designed looking at what had worked in the United States and Australia, what had failed in the United States and Australia, and Keystone and our group felt comfortable with the 0.34 standing support density. We finished the mining of the second right panel in August, started this longwall move, same kind of conditions, 220 foot of overburden, normal lithology, normal mining height of 10 feet, nothing abnormal. We started the one problem we had, MSHA had not given us approval to go with the recovery system, so we had to put on the full amount of Husker screen, thinking that we might have to do a conventional move. At the last second, MSHA gave us the approval, so we carried the mesh a little longer than we should have, and we mined towards the recovery room, put the mesh in. Same kind of thing. We experienced cap rock, uneven roof, slow going. And we were thinking with the roof support out ahead of us and this bolt angling back towards the shields, that might control that cap rock in this area. That was not the case. It was the same story, very slow meshing. When the fender was approximately 15 feet at the tailgate and 18 feet at the head gate, we had a waiting event. You can see what it did in the bottom picture, but we converged 24 inches on the shield legs, the majority of the face, and you see the damage that it did on the pumpable cribs. We continued to battle our way through advancing the shields by shooting and blasting, and at the same time, we had MSHA on the face, which always makes things fun. We had, out of District 9, we had the manager of roof control and ventilation with us. We could not get in that recovery entry to do any repair work until the shields were in final position. They did allow us to go to the chutes and beef the chutes up where necessary, and we just kept inching our way forward. We finally decided the shields were far enough along, we'd change our plan and get into that recovery entry and build a form along the standing, the non-cuttable row of support and the additional standing support that we put in along the solid rib and create a pack wall, an 8-foot pack wall. We took care of that. The picture down on the bottom shows you how bad the shields were ironbound. There's no leg at all left on them. You can see the height. Again, we brought the miner in to gain the height to be able to extract the shields or expedite the shields. So back on the recovery entry side, on the standing room side, we strung out the bradish to create the form. The tech seal was pumped into the void to create a pack wall matching a 900 PSI coal strength. Immediately, the convergence stopped. Within 24 hours, we stopped the convergence and started to shoot and extract shields. During this process, it took 60 days to remove all the shields. So we lost 5 days by going to this recovery room. So it wasn't too good of a move for us. Post-evaluation of two right prior to the waiting transfer, everything was good. But once we started meshing, things went downhill. The thing that we underestimated was the standing support density of a 0.34 was not enough to take care of our standing room. The top picture shows what the fender looked like prior to the event. The bottom picture is after the event. The whole fender blew out. You can see how much screen we had left on the face. Post-evaluation, we had to change our yield valves. We switched to a gas-filled rock burst valve, which did help us. What really helped this move was that 8-foot pack wall that we installed. That slowed everything down. So moving into the third longwall move, we knew that we still had to deal with two things. One, we had to eliminate that meshing. Two, we had to control that cutter. So back to the drawing board, we all grouped up, and I got to tell you, a 70-day plus longwall move, you have a lot of time to think. Again, we needed a safe, quicker, more efficient way of moving the longwall. With the low cover, weak sandstone, heavily jointed strata, and wide face, moving the longwall at that mine is a challenge. Our vision was to install mesh ahead of time where you didn't have to stop. How do you do that? We sat down and figured it out. The next thing was we needed a device in there to prevent that cutter from ever happening. And the third thing, again, we needed a way, we needed enough standing support density to hold that dead load with that shallow cover. So we grouped up, put our plan together, turned it into Keystone, John and his team. They liked it, and we went to work on that. Next thing we did is we jumped on a plane and took off to Australia. Let me back up a little bit. I talked about the Mammoth and the Raider. I wanted a roof bolt that I'd used in Australia that would anchor above that Raider seam. And I'd used it at the one mine in Australia. I'd never seen it in the United States. At that time, it was called a Mega Bolt. So we headed over to Australia. We looked at the Genmar equivalent to the Mega. It's called a Sumo Bolt, 63-ton bolt. We ordered 25 footers and 16 footers. Then we went over to BHP and talked to them for a while about their success stories with the recovery entry. We shared our idea of the recovery mesh in place ahead of time. They were keen on that. And then we went and visited Golder and Associates and talked to those guys for a while. They liked the idea also of putting a screen in. Again, they said it would be the first in the world to have ever tried this. They suggested moving one of the 63-ton sumo bolts, that one would be right above the shield leg, and they also suggested using a fiberglass dowel on that fender to give it some stability. So here's a picture of what our three-right recovery plan would look like. The blues, the first phase is development, and also the first phase of concrete right here. So you mined phase one and the other two entries, and then we backed up and rolled the Husker mesh out, and you had one sumo bolt tight on the rib along the red, and then we backfilled that with a cuttable cement. Once that was cured, we went back in with the miner and took out phase two, 21 foot wide. So 21 and 21, that gives you 42 foot recovery entry, enough room for the mesh and the pullout area. So after the concrete cured, you go in there and you put the rest of the bolts in. It worked very well. CM coordinators don't like it. It's a lot of extra work. There's a side view of the bolts. This is the key to the success of this system. The red bolts are those sumo bolts I just talked about, the 25-foot megas or sumos. This is a 16-foot sumo. This is an angle piece right here with two bolts into the rib to control this cutter. There's your fiberglass dowels to keep stability on that fender as you're mining in from this direction. There's your Husker mesh, and it's supposed to lay down. That's a primary roof bolt. That's just a 5-foot headed rebar, so we wanted to allow that mesh to fall down. And MSHA made us put this in the center just because they were a little bit worried about the gap between phase one and phase two. A little bit on the concrete. We had to maintain 6,000 CFM from head gate to tail gate. We had bore holes from the surface on 120-foot spacing. Made it very easy to backfill. We didn't do any more than 800 cubic yards in a day, and we tried to stay away from anything over 2-foot lifts. So we rotated from hole to hole until we filled this thing. Every day we took samples, every hour on the hour, and all of our results came back with a stronger than an 800 PSI, which that's what we were trying to achieve. We sent cameras down into the boreholes to make sure that we got to the roof. We also had pipes that we ran up to the roof looking for return to make sure that we got to the roof. If in the event during phase two on development we saw any voids, we would have to stop and inject those voids with the polyurethane resin or the equivalent out of the pumpable crib. There was two small areas where we had just small pockets. So the team, the Wright brothers, did a great job injecting the concrete. What's neat here is you look down at the bottom from the two right recovery room, we had the 0.34. We jumped up on standing support density to 5.5. That's as strong as anybody in the country's ever had on standing support density. The RDI jumped up from a 0.99 to a 0.162. Here's some pictures of the backflow of the concrete in the top, flowing in nicely. And there's the mine manager standing next to phase one after phase two mining development was completed. You can see the rock looks pretty good. January of 2014, it's showtime. Same kind of conditions, 200 foot of overburden, same kind of lithology between the two seams, greater than 20 feet between the Raider and the Mammoth. All pillar corners were sharp. There was no sloughage in the area, and we moved in there just like it was supposed to work. As we were mining the fender out, the dowels were exposed. Those are also a good tool for markers for your horizon. And then down at the bottom is the first pass into the concrete, standing straight up and down. We tried three different things on the roof. If you're going to backfill an entry, you don't want to have concrete sticking to the roof. You're going to either have to bolt it or scale it down. We tried popcorn oil. We tried form concrete oil and then Bradish. That was a test area, but this was the area where Bradish was used. It worked very well. None of the oils worked. So if you do it, you want to put plastic or a Bradish up tight to the roof. And this is what you're looking for. The 5-foot headed rebar bolts allowed that roof to break behind the shields. And you can see the Hooskers laying down nice between the shields. There's the final pass. Good floor. Wall standing straight up and down, ready to start tearing down. And then the bottom picture is the breakthrough into one of the chutes. At this time, we had 4 chutes for extraction purposes. Post-evaluation, we're just making a look back on any of the pressures we had, any events. This was a record-setting longwall move for Signal Peak from finishing mining of coal in panel 2 to panel 3. We were back in the coal on day 24. It only took 15 days to extract the shields off the face versus the 55 and the 60, so it was a home run. We did have 2 events, small events, and these are based off shield pressures. The first event was 4 feet from the concrete, 4 foot of coal left from the concrete, and then we had a second event. It was right on the first pass in the concrete. And again, only 3.5 inches versus going ironbound on the previous 2 moves. Real quick, we just fly through the 4 right recovery plan. We made just a few changes. Number 1, we backed off 800 PSI backfill to a 600 PSI backfill. We added 1 more chute. We went from 4 chutes to 5. The primary support switched from 6-foot from a 5-foot headed rebar, and that's because I did that mine wide for different reasons. And then MSHA didn't have our plan in time, and we had a window of opportunity to do this development. We had to cut phase 1 20 feet wide, which made it a little bit tight on the mesh. Phase 2, we had the MSHA approval, and we cut it 22 feet. Everything else was the same. Same dowels, same bolts. Same thing on the concrete. We tried to keep our lifts less than 2 feet. Stayed at 800 cubic yards a day, and we lost a little bit of standing support density. We dropped from a 5.5 down to a 4.34, I believe that says, 5.14, and RDI dropped to a 1.58, but still a success story. We actually gained, here's a picture of some concrete flowing in again. A picture of me standing next to phase 1 after phase 2 development was done. Concrete looked good. Really couldn't see a change with the 600 PSI from the 800 PSI, but it did flow better. As we were cutting it, it flowed better on the conveyor systems in the pan line. This time we gained 1 day. We were able to shave 1 day off of removing the shields. The picture down below shows basically what we had in the 3 right. Again, you can see the dowels. That middle picture is interesting. There's how thin the fender was. It's kind of sloughing just a little bit. but there's the backfills exposed, a little bit of concrete right in that area. And again, there's your full face of backfill. Same thing, mesh laid down nicely, even with the additional foot on the headed rebar, the 6-foot bolt. And that was 100% lined with Bradish this time. You can see that concrete stayed off of the roof bolts and the mesh. Some more final pictures. Had a little bit of sloughing in chute 4, but nothing major. And we spent, we had one loading event this time versus 2. And that was the first pass into the concrete. And longwall extraction only took 14 days versus 15. So there's where we gained the 1 day. Another success story. I'll let Bob finish up on the technical stuff. He's got some nice videos to show you guys.
I'm just going to make a quick review of the instrumentation that we put into the coal fender and into the backfill. You can see from the diagram that the majority of the instrumentation for the 3-right longwall move was installed into the coal fender. This was a joint effort between Signal Peak and NIOSH. It was extensive monitoring, including extensometers and I call it a multi-point extensometer that was mounted into the roof above the coal. And it was able to monitor reaction of the roof. The review at site 1 is near the head gate, and site 4 is mid-face. And you can see, this is in the coal fender, that as mining approached the backfill, the pressure did increase. The magnitude of the pressure on the headgate side was, you know, around 50 psi, and at site 4, a typical was slightly higher, approaching 100 psi. This is, went the wrong way. Here we go, 4-right. I knew I was going forward here. 4-right instrumentation, the emphasis was on the backfill. And we installed borehole pressure cells at 2 locations. I call them long and short. One of them was 9 feet and the other one was 36 feet. We had a 42-foot wide backfill again. And the results were similar to what we saw in 3-right. Again, site 1 was near the head gate, and site 4 was, these are the long and short. Pressures were relatively low. We saw the most pressure when we made our first cut. We feel like the location of the fiberglass dowels and the fender did contribute to the success. We think that the location and the strength of the sumo bolt was also a factor in maintaining the roof. The sensor and leg pressure showed that our pressure was loading when we made our first pass into the backfill. And we didn't really see big increases or any abutment pressure. Doesn't sound like much for all the instrumentation, but that's really what we learned. I'm going to show a little bit of the subsidence, and this slide is just to show that within 100 feet of the advancing face, we are observing surface expression of the subsidence. And you can see also by the lower diagram that we're not seeing subsidence influences from previous panels. The panel to the left-hand side is showing literally no movement, so the chain pillars are not affected. We're not seeing influence from one panel to the next. This is time-lapse video on the surface from 3 right. It's 24 hours. I've got it kind of condensed down to about 45 seconds. Say this movement was probably about 1 foot. And right at the end, if you watch close, get to see the gate open. Really, by the next morning, it was almost kind of back to normal again, you'll see. And the backfilling, I think, was another interesting phenomena. This material is, again, this is a 24-hour video. It looks really, it is, it's fluid. The last one is a chute breakthrough. This is from the 3 right. It demonstrates that the roof was controlled. You can see how sharp and defined the walls were at the chute. That's generally the most critical area, and we are successful in controlling this roof. I guess with that, there might be time for questions.
Any questions? Yeah. They do. And yeah, they do. In fact, the next longwall move, we're going to go to a 32-foot sumo. You can get them any length you want. Key on this move was getting above that rater, help build that beam. So we're getting a little more than the 20 feet between the two seams. So we're going to a 32-footer. Custom ordered out of Australia. Cheap bolt, too. Yeah. You know what? That's a good question. What was it, Bob? He did not measure it. Thanks, Steve. Thank you.